Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm a Mac alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 26, 1987. And there's some really, there's a lot of new people here. Welcome, man. It's great when there's a lot of old-timers, but it's really awesome when there's a lot of really new people here. You know, and if you don't judge your sobriety by my story, you can really, from my story, you can really get a lot of hope that if I can stay sober, that you can, there's a lot of hope for you. And there's a lot of hope that you don't have to go to the depths of insanity I went to get sober. It's not necessary to do the insane crap that I did. But that if you have a lot of insanity in your life, that there is hope. Tim let me talk to a guy tonight at the dinner about what if I do the steps, what if they don't work? You know, it's like not doing too good of a job not working them. But I love working with new people. I sponsor a lot of people. Our book talks about when all else fails, constant thought of others and constant working with others. Nothing else will save the day more than that. And I do a lot of that all the time. My house, there's people there all the time. There's newcomers there all the time. We have book studies at my house all the time. There's, you know, there's just constant people there all the time. It's hard to get pressed when newcomers are there whining all the time. You know, you know, and that wasn't my first sobriety date. You know, I went in and out a lot. You know, in our doctor's opinion in our book, it says that we suffer from a physical allergy once we put alcohol in our body that we can't determine when we're going to quit drinking. And I know that to be true in my life. I knew that before I ever went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so as we have this mental obsession that's going to tell us to drink, no matter what, the condition or whatever. And I know that to be true. But you see, I wanted to die. You know, I never wanted to live. I don't ever remember as a child, never before I took a drink, thinking, oh boy, life's good. And so going to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and them explaining that doctor's opinion to me and understanding that I suffer from a spiritual malady, you know, none of that stuff meant anything to me. You know, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy there who said, if I took a drink, one more drink, I'll die. And I went up to him after that meeting and said, can we go try that? So that information absolutely meant nothing to me. I knew all that stuff to be true. I knew I was in full flight from reality. I knew I was couldn't differentiate the true from the false, but I wanted to die. You know, I never gave Alcoholics Anonymous a chance for 12 years. Because I thought dying was going to be the answer to my problems. You know, alcohol, you know, I mean, I waited a long time before I ever drank. And it really pissed me off once. I found out, you know, in the doctor's opinion, it says we drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And once I didn't have to be taught to guzzle booze, it came naturally. The book talks that most of us crossed over an invisible line never ever to return to normal drinking. I never drank normally. I intuitively knew how to guzzle right from the beginning. I never drank normally. Loved blacking out drinking. You know, right in the beginning, I was started out blacking out drinking. That was a real safe place for me. I love not remembering what happens when I drink. I always hated that when people say, "Do you remember what you did last night?" And it's like, hell no, and don't tell me either. You know, I don't care to know. But I was, it was in the summer before the fourth grade when I started drinking, and when I found out what alcohol, how good that could make me feel, it pissed me off. I waited so long, you know, and it wasn't very long after that I found out I could drink in the morning, and it made the day go really good. And so I could not see no reason not to start drinking in the morning every day. Because if it made the afternoon go by so good, then you know that you could drink in the morning, and it would just make the day go really good. And it made me fit into life. You know, it didn't make. I was this scared little wimpy little punk kid. You know, I was afraid of everything. You know, I couldn't fight. I was afraid of girls. I couldn't dance. I couldn't play any sports. I was ugly. I had blonde hair. I had blue eyes. I was skinny. I was, you know, I didn't fit in anywhere. And I could drink alcohol. Man, I became tough guy at school instantly the first day. I became the toughest kid on campus, you know, and it made me somebody, man. And I liked that. I didn't like crying going home because the kids picked on me at school, and I didn't like being the ugly kid on campus. I liked being the best looking dude on campus, and I liked the girls paying attention to me, you know, and I liked being able to dance, and you know, I liked all that. And but you know, the problem is it's hard to get booze in the fourth grade. So you got to get into a little bit of stealing, and you start getting in trouble, and you know you start going to juvenile hall, and you know our book says we're ruled by 100 forms of fear, and you know everything that goes on in my life, I my life is run totally on fear as long as I can remember. And alcohol served all the purposes of getting rid of that fear. But everything that came up, going to juvenile hall, I was riddled with fear. But you know, after you start going and all the other kids look up to you, man, you're a tough guy, man. You've been to juvenile hall. You're somebody. You know, it ain't too bad anymore. And you know, when you're riddled by fear, you know, and you go in there, you just whip ass as soon as you get in there. And it gets around juvenile hall that there's this tough kid in there named Matt Green. Don't mess with him. He'll whip your ass. And you become the big shot in campus at juvenile hall, too. I mean, it's not really a whole lot to look up to, but, you know, I mean, I didn't, you know, grow up thinking, man, I'm going to be the big shot at juvenile hall, you know, and run juvenile hall. But, you know, as long as you got to be there, you might as well be somebody, you know. You know, I never dreamed that my life was going to be progressively. I was going to have to progressively do crazier and crazier things, you know. You know, alcoholism is a progressive illness and it gets worse. But you know what? The life I had, that I had to lead to stay on top of the game and to be ahead of trying to keep people away from me so they wouldn't know that really that deep down inside I'm full of fear and I'm afraid and I'm really this weak little sissy kid and to stay on top of the game was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. And, you know, and there came a point in my time when alcohol didn't serve that purpose anymore. You know, and I had to add some things that we're not supposed to talk about here, you know, and it's like, you know, on The night before I turned 13, I'm running with the Hells Angels already, and I moved in with the president of the Fresno chapter of the Hells Angels, and I like this scene, you know, because wherever we run, and I'm riding Harley Davidsons now, and wherever we go, people are afraid of us, and we get to do whatever we want, and I like that scene. That was safe for me, you know. I don't have to worry about anybody. Those guys protected me, and they didn't let nobody screw with me. No, you know, and it was a safe, comfortable place for me, you know. If I try, everywhere I went before there, you know, I mean, my parents were alcoholics, and they got a divorce, and any drunken boyfriends, when my mom did show up at the house, I got the shit beat out of me, and one guy molested me, and now I'm around with the Hells Angels, and you know what, these guys, they don't let nothing happen to me, you know, and I'm safe, and I want to be part of this deal, and the night before I turned 13, if I would have known I was going to be in Portland, Oregon on this night, in the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and them guys held out them drugs to me, I would have had to tell them, no, man, I'm going to be speaking at a function, I can't take no narcotics, you know, because... We got a thing in Alcoholics Anonymous called singleness of purpose, so I can't take the narcotics, you know. But I didn't know I was going to be at an A function tonight, so I wanted to be part of the deal. So that, you know, I was drunk enough. They held out these pills, and I didn't say what are they or what will they do, or I want to belong to it so desperately. I took them all, and it wasn't my first blackout, but I remember that I came to in the morning and thought, man, I took some of that stuff, and man, I'm worthless, and this was in the early 60s, and, you know, narcotics that was a pretty big no-no back then, and I'm thinking, man, you know, I really blew it now, and I can't get up and go to work, and they come in and they say, take this white stuff, you'll make it to work. And you know, I don't say, how much do you take or what will it do or anything. I just take it. And I don't know how you guys do things, but I always overshoot the mark, always. And I'm working this transmission shop, and my boss, he gets loaded and drinks and stuff. And I take transmissions out, and they rebuild them, and I put them back in. And my boss comes over and he kicks the creeper and goes, man, you must have took too much of that white crap. You're not getting any work done. All you're doing is spinning round and round on the creeper, man. He goes, you better drink something and slow down. I must have overshot that mark because next thing I know, he's kicking the creeper again. And so all I was doing now is sleep, and I better take some more of that white shit. And that started some years of taking whatever it took to get through life. You know, taking stuff to wake up, taking stuff to slow down, drinking. You know, drinking is my thing. I love to drink, no matter what I mix with it. If you never added nothing to your drinking, you screwed yourself, man. There's nothing better than seeing, you know, 28 days of closing time without ever going to bed, you know. I mean, that's just... You know, if you go home and go to bed, what if she was there? And I I've been married 4 times without ever getting divorced, you know, so if you're home in bed, you know, you can miss a lot of shit, you know. Yeah, I was never going to stick a needle in my arm, and that ended up coming true, and so I get to thinking, man, I wonder what some tequila gold would do in that needle, and it works real good. Makes the inside of your body feel like it's on fire, but, you know, you got to be willing to go to any lengths, right? And You know, I kept going in and out of the institutions, and, you know, for the crimes I'm committing, you know, I'm not even 18, I'm already going to the psychiatric units for the crimes I'm committing, and you know, I'm wearing my colors and running with the angels and thinking life's awesome, and I end up in CYA, and, oh, this is Oregon, yeah, so in California, it's called California Youth Authority, and, you know, I want to turn 18 to go to jail. You know, like, you know, if you're a bad boy, you know, in doing the crime and stuff, the more you get locked up, the more notoriety you get, and it's just expected that you get locked up and do those kind of things. So it's just part of the game you do, but I want to be 18 to go to jail, not you know, CYA and stuff. You know how embarrassing it is to be a Hell's Angel and go to CYA and shit, you know. And, you know, my dream comes true, man. I turn 18, and a week later, I'm in jail. And we've been robbing this Taco Bell, you know, and we had it set up with the manager of this place. And he let us know when to come by and rob it, when they'd have the most money there, and he'd be in the back, and we'd split it three ways, or he thought we split it three ways. He got the smallest share, but this one day we met these blondes. You know, blondes have always screwed me over. I'm powerless over blondes. They always get me in trouble. And we're drinking some tequila gold, and these two blondes, they got this stuff they had back then called this orange sunshine. And they want us to take it with them. No, we got some business to take care of tonight. And they kept bugging us, and finally we took some. And we go by the Taco Bell to rob it, and the goddamn place is closed. And we got this deal going down the next day, and we need some money. And we find this rich restaurant to rob, and you know, we had a good plan. You know, alcoholics always got a good plan. You know what I'm saying? And I was going to rob the bar cash register, and Mark was going to rob the restaurant cash register, and we were going to get the heck out of there. And it was a good plan, and it would have worked. It really would have worked. We've done it a lot of times. But we got in there, and we're on this friggin' acid, and you know, when we're doing armed robberies, we don't take stuff like that. We just drink and do armed robberies, and I mean, this was a really, really, it was one of the richest restaurants in Fresno at the time, and really, really rich people wear a lot of diamonds, and when you're loaded on acid, that... diamonds really sparkle, and so we decided to rob everybody in the place too, and so we were in there too long, and a cop walks in and says freeze, and it freaked me out, and I shot that cop, and so we're sitting in jail, and it's like, damn. I mean, I didn't mind shooting a cop, but I didn't want to start off there, you know. It's like I had this plan on my 21st birthday to be doing, I wanted to rob a bank and have the national news there, and I'm going to come out and I'm going to have a shootout with the cops, and I'm going to make it to my Harley, and the national news, I'm going to make it down the street, and we're going to be having a shootout, and me and that Harley are going to go end over end. I'm going to be shot a bunch of times. It's going to be on the national news. I'm going to die on my 21st birthday. And it's going to be cool then, but not as soon as I turn 18. And so I want to go to jail for like assault and battery or minor robbery or something. So I'm thinking, dang, man. And I don't believe in God. Not at all. And I'm not one of those guys that get to jail and say, oh, God, if you get me out of this, you know, I'll do that. I don't do that. And when I go to jail, I used to tell everybody how tough I am. I don't call nobody. I don't get no visits. I don't nothing. The truth of it was I couldn't take the look from the other side of the glass. I always did my time by myself. And it was strictly because I couldn't take the look from the other side of the glass. One time in juvenile hall, my parents came. And just that look from the other side of the glass, that disgusting look that you get, I couldn't take that. So I always acted that I was just real tough. But the truth was I just couldn't take that look. And so I never would call anybody or anything. But I thought if I could get out of this somehow, what could I do different? And I thought maybe I'll get married. But, you know, I mean, that's... When you get married, you know, you're supposed to act like you care and show feelings and so. And it's not that I didn't want to do that, but that's a real scary place for a guy like me, because if you show that you care, that means you're weak and you're vulnerable and people will take advantage of you and they'll use you and it'll be a sign of weakness and you can't do that. But the cops screwed up and I got off those charges. I beat those charges. And so I thought, well, I need to slow this down. And so I checked with all 7 girls I was engaged to at the time. I don't know about you guys, but booze isn't... more of everything is better for me. And back then, you know, if you got a girl pregnant, you did the right thing, you married her. And one of those girls said she was pregnant, and so, you know, we had a Hell's Angel wedding in Reno, and it was an awesome wedding. You know, we got her loaded, and she passed out, and we went out, and we had a hell of a party. And we showed back up to pick her up 3 days later, and she was pissed, but we had a good time. And that girl, you know, she really took advantage of me, because that kid didn't pop out for 18 months. And we weren't even together then, you know. How I do marriages is, you know, you get married and, you know, you're apart a couple months later, and you get together every so often, every 3 or 4 months, and spend a weekend together or something. But over the next couple of years, I ended up married to 4 girls and not divorced to any of them yet. And I would just come to all these blackouts, and here'd be another girl and show me a wedding certificate, and it's like, damn. You know, so I rent another house and put up another wife, and it's like, when that happened with the 4th one, you know, it's like I didn't have time to go rent another house, and I got 3 wives already, and it's like, so I took the 4th one home to the 3rd one, and that wasn't working out real good. And you know, in the book where it talks about our lives are unmanageable, you know, it was a little unmanageable back then, but, you know, it wasn't my fault, you know. You know, I'm going to jail all the time, and another cop had gotten shot, and I beat those charges, and... You know, I really don't like where my life's really going, and I'm just really, I'm in and out of the psychiatric units and for the crimes I'm committing, and I'm not really doing no time. I'm buying judges off, I'm making a ton of money, you know, I got my contractor's license, and I'm selling tons of stolen merchandise. I had a couple of warehouses of stolen merchandise, and selling a ton of that other stuff we're not supposed to talk about here, and just, you know, but I really you know, I'm trying to play this role of this Hell's Angel gangster guy, but I really don't like the things we're doing and where my life has gone, and there's no way out, and I want out, and I want to die desperately, and I can't die, and I'm starting to pull the gun on cops and not pull the trigger, and they're shooting me, and I'm coming through all surgeries, and I can't die, and I joined the Army, the Vietnam War is going on, I think that'll straighten me out, and you know, the first 10 minutes I'm in the Army, you know, I beat the shit out of the drill sergeant, and they do shit like yell and scream at you and expect you to do shit, you know, and I'm locked up in there, you know, and thinking this is a bad decision to join the Army, you know, and they called it escape. You know, I'm the kind that cuts and runs. When the going gets tough, I just cut and run. I don't deal with nothing. You don't yell at me. I don't deal with nothing. I just leave. I don't deal with anything. And they called it escape, but I was just tired of playing their game. And I left, and the first thing I could find to get back to Fresno was an armored truck. So they threw me in a federal penitentiary for that, you know, and the war was going on, and so the military government came and got me out, and they decided they didn't want me no more, and I'm almost 21. Life was really going downhill bad. You know, I ended up in a Tascadero psychiatric hospital. It was new then. It was in California. It was built for the criminally insane, violent criminally insane people. It was a new deal they were going to try out, you know, for us really violent criminals. And it was a long-term observation type thing. So they sent me over there, and I don't know how the hell they observe shit over there, because, you know, the same as wherever I got sent for these observation things, but I was over there 4.5 months, and they kept us so thorazine down so we couldn't create no problems or anything. And I'll tell you what a day was like in there. It was like we'd make it from the bed to the day room, and we could smoke back in the facilities back then, and actually, the cigarettes were free back then, too, but we couldn't have lighters or anything. And so you'd sit down at the day table, and you'd work on trying to get the cigarette in your mouth, you know. And sometimes through the day, you'd get it in there, you know. And then in the back wall in the day room there was this. It was like a cigarette lighter in your car, and it was indentured in this wall, and it was glowing red the whole time, and you'd go and you'd aim for that hole in the wall, you know. And when you thought you were lined up, you just fell forward. The problem with that is if you missed the hole, you were screwed. But if you made it in the hole, then you just went back over the table and you couldn't smoke it. You just watched it like this, and the cigarette ashes would fall down, and when it got to the filter, the cherry would just fall down, and you just get up and go to bed. And it took all day just to do that. And 4.5 months later, they observed me and diagnosed me as homicidal and incapable of adapting to society way of life for the rest of my life. It's like, how the hell did you get that out of that? I didn't understand that one. You know what I mean? That, you know, I mean, so now you get a picture of what my life's like, and now I'm starting to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm staying sober, but I'm doing speed. You know, because they would test us for alcohol back then, but not for narcotics. And we only had an hour and a half meetings back then. And you know how hard it is to sit an hour and a half meeting loaded on speed? The longest damn meetings I ever sat in my life, you know. But sometimes I would go and not take nothing. And I would get a sponsor. And sometimes I would do some four steps even. They damn sure weren't truthful. But I would never do no service work. And I would never make no amends. You know, I wonder why Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't work for me. You know, and get the sponsor. Sometimes I get the sponsor and then change home groups, because then that way you don't have to see that sponsor no more. But, you know, but that way when everybody asks you, you got a sponsor? Oh, hell yeah. Got his name, too. Just like those guys and those new people lined up over here. They said they got a sponsor. I bet you half of them would have been screwed if Tim asked them, do you ever call them? I know I would have been. You know, I did that, you know, and I could get 10 months sober, 11 months sober. And, you know, and every time, you know, what I didn't realize is the will to live was every time I went back out. You see, when I don't drink and I don't thoroughly do Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sober, I want to die worse than ever. And the will to live, every time I go back out, is worse and worse and worse. And I don't know why, you know, this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work for a guy like me. You know, I mean, hell, you know, towards the last years, I go to 3 to 5 meetings a day. I mean, shit, what more do you want? Have a sponsor? Because every time I go back, I do a little bit more and a little bit more. But I never do the full thing. And I never do get honest either. I mean, a little bit. I mean, shit. Nobody here gets all the way honest. You know, I have a book. It collects dust. You know, but... You know, and I want to die more and more, and, you know, I just, you know, and I could always, every time I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous within a matter of a couple of months or a month or 2 months, you know, I could have my business up and running. I could have another good-looking blonde on my hanging on my arm again, and I could have another new Lincoln, and I could have another new Harley Davidson again. I could have another ranch again. I could have... You know, another 50 grand in the bank again, and I could be looking good again, and, you know, running in and out of the means of Alcoholics Anonymous and having a bunch of people hanging around again and, you know, wanting what I got again, but inside desperately wanting to die more and more each time and wondering why this thing doesn't work for me. But I'm running in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous saying, man, you know what, being sober is the greatest thing ever happened to me. And wanting to die desperately. You know, and by the time I married my 7th wife, you probably think you missed something, huh? I don't know what time I started now. You know, I'm 30 years old now, and I wanted to die desperately for years and years. You know, life was supposed to have been over, you know, a long time ago, and I got this 9th wife, and I got another ranch, and we had a kid. This is my 3rd child now, and I got the Lincoln again, a new Harley again, got a brand new lowrider, and got the cows and the horses and the pigs and pool tables and all that shit again, and the spas and everything again, and got 50 employees again, and, you know, got 100 grand in the bank again, and just, you know, everything looks good. And I really, really, really want to die. You know, I've been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years at that time, and a couple years go by, and I'm running in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit because, you know, I'm a big shot again, you know, and I got all this money again, and I got this good-looking blonde again, and, you know, we're married, and I run her off, you know. And she won't come back, and she gives me a call and says, hey, you know what, I'm going to run off with this kid so you can't ever see him again. I get to thinking, you know what, I'm not going to let another wife do this to me. I'm going to go blow her head off, and I've been on about a week-long run, and I grab a shotgun, and I stop at 7-Eleven, and I buy two bottles of champagne to celebrate blowing her head off, and I get over there, and she's not there, and neighbors are there, and they know how crazy I am, and how long I've been locked up, and, you know, it just don't matter anymore, and I kick the door in, and I'm just guzzling this booze, and I'm waiting for her to come home so I can blow her head off, and the SWAT team shows up, and I don't know why I can't shoot another cop. But I'm a tough guy, and I can't go out there and say, hey, I give up, let's go to jail. And I get to thinking my children are better off without me in this world. You know, society deserves what I did to them, man. You know what? Society made me this animal. It's not my fault. You know, but my children deserve me sucking air that they deserve better than me being around, you know. And then, you know, my older children were saying they were tired of seeing me on the news for the crimes I'd committed and being wanted. And I sucked that shotgun in my head and I pulled the trigger. And when I came to out of that coma months and months later, you know, I'm most of the way blind, so this is just a big blur, but I was all the way blind back then, and I have a plate that if I pop this plate out of my mouth, I still can't talk, and I didn't have a plate then, and I've had like 87 major surgeries. I've had hundreds and hundreds of surgeries, but put me back together, so I had a big hole in my head, and I had tubes sticking out of me everywhere, and I was hooked up to life support systems, and doctors came in every day, and they had every part of my body that would move, they had strapped down with leather restraints, and doctors came in every day and told me, boy, there's nothing we can do for you, you're going to die. And that's where I got introduced to you jerks again. The people that are in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, they do it whether the person gets sober or not. And that was the case with me. I didn't, you know, they came in there and they'd knock on the door and they'd sit down and they'd ask me if they could read me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, like I had a choice in this matter. You know? And they'd take turns reading me that book all day long. Day after day, week after week, month after month. They did that for about 11 months. Well, I was strapped to that friggin' bed and couldn't say nothing, couldn't nothing. You know, so desperately I wanted to tell them, you know what, I'm an alcoholic, but see, my case is a little bit different than you. I'm blind and I'm dying. You see, if there's one thing different than me than you, then I don't have to do what you do, you see. And I always want to find one thing where I'm different than you so I don't have to do what you do. So my case is different than you. And you see, now I'm blind and I'm dying, so I'm definitely different than you. I always got to have something where I'm different than you so I don't have to do what you do. And they brought this tape deck up there, this little portable tape deck, and they brought, I don't know how many freaking cassette tapes up there. And when they would leave, they'd say, you want to listen to tape? I couldn't wiggle my head. Yes, no. I couldn't say yes, no. And they'd put a tape on. And you know how at nighttime, how the nurses come and take your vital signs every hour or so, all night long? Well, the tapes were then, the nurses thought I liked it so good, so they'd change the tape all night long. You know how many speakers I heard in 11 months, man? And then I get out of the hospital, finally, I do live, as you can tell. And man, there's a lot of years, you know, I shot a lot of people, I destroyed a lot of families and homes, and just ran over a lot of people, and, you know, I made the national news again, And they come by, you want to go to an AA meeting? Hell yeah. Now people know I'm blind. Now they're going to come take advantage of me. So, now I want to hide out in AA. I want to go to as many meetings as I can go to a day. So I get the sponsor again, and I'm doing a lot of things. I'm going to 3 to 5 meetings every day, and I'm calling this guy. I'm working stuff, but I got a secret, and I don't do no service work, and I have one huge secret. So over the next 2 years, I drank 3 times, and the 4th time I saved up all my pills from my surgeries that I could save without taking, and I had 455 synthetic morphine pills, and I took those. That was when I got the last time, and I guzzled them down with 2 half gallons of vodka. I thought for sure that would work. And when I came to out of that coma, I was really pissed. It's like, what I got to do to die? And that's when I realized that, you know what, there must be a God in this world. And this God in this world, if he's not done with you, you're not going to die. I don't care what you do. And I firmly believe that to this day, that if God's not done with you, you're not going to die. You can do whatever you want to. And if God's not done with you, you're not going to die. And people ask me, well, then why do little children get to die? Why do little children die? What'd they do? And I believe that if a little child dies, there's a reason why God wants to take them. There's probably something really seriously wrong with that child, and it's time for God to take them home. I really believe that. I don't believe that God takes anybody before it's time that God wants them to come home, whether it's a little child or not. And I don't know the reasons why God does that. Only God knows that. If I knew that, I would be God. I wouldn't need a God. And it's hard. I had a hard time with that in the beginning of my sobriety, why God would do things like that. But today I believe God has a reason for those things, and it's not for me to understand, but I believe that God wasn't going to let me die, that I was just going to keep missing body parts. And I was too weak to stand up, and I rolled out of that bed, and I just looked up, and it was a cussing prayer. And I believe that God understands that we do the best we could, and I don't pray that way today. And it was basically, God, whatever you want me to do, and whatever Alcoholics Anonymous wants me to do, I'll do it. I'm tired of fighting it anymore. And I went to a new meeting that day. I told the old timers that what had happened, and I was willing to do anything they wanted me to do. And I said, so what do you want me to do? And they go, boy. They call me boy, and it pissed me off. I'm a Hell's Angel. I'm a convict. I ain't no damn boy, And I used to tell them, the only reason why you call me a boy is I can't find you to whip your ass. And but they go, boy, we want you to go out and pick up the cigarette butts. And I go, that ain't happening, man. You guys want to have this circus act and we'll get out, gather at the window and watch a blind boy pick up the cigarette butts, And so we thought you made a deal with God that you would do anything you said. And it's like, all right. So I went out and picked up the cigarette butts, and that was over 23 years ago, and God hasn't sent me a fax saying, you picked up enough cigarette butts, so I still pick up the cigarette butts. I'm not one of those that gets a lot of time, like a lot of people do when they get, a lot of years and say, I'll leave that shit for the newcomers to do. I don't have to do it anymore. I hear that kind of shit around here. I'm one that believes, if God designed this stuff for us to do and we're new, I believe God still wants us to do it no matter how many years we have. They told me when I had 5 days of sobriety, they go, boy, we need you to go to jail. The meetings aren't being covered. I said, I ain't going to jail. I got warrants for my arrest. Back then, we didn't have to have clearances and stuff. And I said, boy, we don't care. You're going to go do the meeting. It's like, damn. So I went and did the meeting at the jail and scared to death. I'm not going to get out of there. And next day they go, how's it going? I said, good, but I ain't going back. And they said, well, it's not being covered very well. We need you to go every week for a year. And it's like, damn. So last February 1st, I've been doing it for 23 years now. And what I did was I just got real involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'd hear people talk all the time in meetings, you know, and about, you know, I'm 3 years sober and I'm getting ready to work my third step, and people say, oh, you're right where you're supposed to be, all that kind of bullshit you hear in meetings. And they're getting drunk and stuff, and you know, and I talked to some old-timers and stuff, and they said, you know what, you need to get some relief. You need to get through those steps just as fast as you can get through them. That's a bunch of bullshit. And so I went through the steps a little over 60 days. You know, our book talks about it's a lifetime of inventories that we're going to be taking, that we need to go through these steps as fast as possible and get some relief. You know, if anybody, I sponsor a lot of people, and if you want to take your time and me be your sponsor, that shit ain't happening, man. You know, that the guys I sponsor, and I get them to the steps as fast as possible, and they thank me for the relief they get from that. And you know, if you're going to be in my sponsorship line, you're constantly going to be doing inventory. You're constantly going to be writing. You know, the book talks about that a lot. You know, I see too many people that, you know, people tell them, take your time, slow down, you know, and they're getting drunk, man. You know, it's not the way they did it in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, somewhere this message, I believe, has gotten diluted, man, and people aren't staying sober. That's my opinion. You know, everybody can work it how they want, that's true, but it's just, I don't know, it seems like people are taking it easy and slowing down and just, I don't know, people aren't getting the relief they need through the process of the steps. You know, and I hear people, oh, I just, you know, God, I'm working and I got kids and, you know, people don't like to do that shit to me because I was a single dad. And, I wasn't married when I got sober. I had this baby in diapers and I was blind and I had 7 commitment meetings a week and I had 7 service commitments a week. You know, it was pretty extreme, but, you know, I just didn't want to drink anymore. And you know what? And so right in the beginning of it and diving into these steps and working with these old timers, I found it wasn't about the drinking. It was about the insanity. I didn't want to live in insanity in my head anymore. I wanted to find a new way to live comfortable with me. And it was through the service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so right away, they got me into getting into service in my community and doing some volunteer things for, you know, the stuff I'd done that I was never able to make amends for. You know, for, you know, some armed robberies that I'd done that those places are out of business for just stuff that I'd never be able to make amends for. And I got, you know, I ended up becoming the chairman, or the whatever you call it, of the neighborhood watch in my area. And, you know, I shared with my neighbors how to better secure their houses, and they think I'm just, you know, they think I'm smarter than shit, you know, and, Your book talks about that we will act and react normally, insanely, and you know what? That's what's happened in my life. You know, this little boy that, you know, I ended up in sobriety getting 100% custody of him. A lot of you guys seen him over in Seaside at the conference. He's 25 years old now. That kid, you know, I have 3 children, 4 grandchildren, but that kid, you know, grew up with me in sobriety. You know, that kid calls me a couple times a day. My kids call me about their relationship problems. My oldest kid, he's kind of worthless. His mother enables the shit out of him. He smokes dope. He doesn't know what responsibility is. He was 13 years old when I got sober, and his mother just enables the shit out of him, and unfortunately, that kid's kind of worthless. He's 37 years old today. It's sad to see what her guilt and stuff does, and she won't let go of that, and that kid's really paying the price, but like I said, a lot of you seen that kid that was over at the Seaside Conference with me, and that kid, you know, and it doesn't mean that your kids are going to turn out good, you know. But you know what? If you raise your kids with these principles that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, they got a hell of a lot better chance than they do if you don't raise them with these principles that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there was 2 girls here with a day sober, and one of them had 5 years before, so you know sometimes in sobriety you're going to suck, but you know what, some of the best times of your life, the absolute best times of your life are going to be in sobriety. You know, my first year, man, you're going to hear that crap around here all the time. Keep coming back. It gets better. My first year, man, I went back with that 7th ex-wife. And, it was my place. I ran this place. She moved into my place. It was my car, my stuff, my everything. That gets you in a lot of trouble there. That alcoholic song, I. Me. Anyways, I was gone to a noon meeting, and she changed the locks and moved her boyfriend in. I was brand new in sobriety, and that really pissed me off. I got indicted for income tax evasion for $543,000. My first year, I had a emergency back surgery. My first year, my house got raided for a drug raid. They had the wrong address in the middle of the night. I got thrown out in the middle of a busy intersection, butt naked, sober. I got indicted for murder at 9 months sober. And I go, man, if this shit gets any better, I don't know if I could take it, you know? But I did get 100% custody of that youngest child in sobriety. You know, a worthless scumbag like me, a ex-convict, a Hell's Angel, long-ass record. I got 100% custody of that child. You know, at 10 years sober, 9 of my closest relatives died in 9 months. And 2 of those being my parents. And at 9 years sober, that pride and joy youngest child of mine, they performed the wrong surgery on him. And over the next 3.5 months, he almost died twice. They told me he'd never make it through the night. He was going to die. And thank God for the people I sponsor and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that lived in the hospital with me, and surgery after surgery, hospital after hospital, and he lived through it. But it was a nightmare, you know, and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous carried me through that. At 10 years sober, this best friend I had in Al-Anon, that Al-Anon talk tonight was absolutely awesome, wasn't it? Amen. My best friend in Al-Anon that was involved in tons of service, and we were on a lot of conference committees together and stuff, and we did a lot of stuff together, and we were the best of friends. Should have left it that way. I asked her to marry me. And on her wedding date outside the wedding chapel, I told my sponsor, this isn't right. You know, I care about her a lot. She's the best friend in the world. But it's just not enough to be married. And he goes, you don't have to go through with it. You know what? I'm a big shot circuit speaker. And we both are involved in tons of service, and we're both active as hell, and we enjoy being around each other. We've lived together for a year. I'll make it work. You know, our book talks about, where have I put myself in a position to be harmed? There's nothing I can say about that lady and how that divorce ended, because I was wrong in going through with that marriage. It turned out to be ugly. And we don't talk anymore, and we were best of friends at one time. And I knew better, and I went through with it anyways. So I was the one at fault for going through with that marriage, and not pretty. And I was never ever going to sit next to a girl in a meeting. I was never going to take a girl to a panel. You know, I love my life just the way it is, running all over the country, doing what I do in AA, sponsoring all the people I sponsor. Doing what I'm doing, hey, I'm just, my kids, my grandchildren, I'm happy just the way it is. I was being a smart ass, speaking from the plains of Alcoholics Anonymous, saying I'm accepting resumes for my 9th ex-wife. And I was speaking up north in California, and this little tiny 98 pound, 5 foot tall, of course a blonde, long blonde hair, girl came up to me, about 6.5 years ago now, and told me she had a resume for me. And I fell madly in love with that girl. We fell madly in love with each other. And she lived in the Bay Area, and I lived in Fresno, and it was a long-distance relationship. And, you know, for the first time in my life, I found out what love was really about. Sounds funny after being married and divorced 8 times, huh? But I finally found out what love was really, really about. And it was the most perfect relationship. And it's like, God, how come I had to go through 8 wives to figure out what it was really about? And it was absolutely awesome, man. And she was involved in tons of service in Alcoholics Anonymous up in the Bay Area, and you know, and I was, and she was running, you know, when she could, and she was running to conferences where I was speaking at, and I was running over, and she was involved in conferences over in the Bay Area, and the NCCA conferences in Northern California, and it was the most awesome thing I ever experienced in my life. For 4.5 years, a month from today would have been 2 years ago. Well, she died a month from today, 2 years ago she died. But a week before that, she went for a doctor's appointment, and her neck had been bothering her, so she scheduled a doctor's appointment, and she went to see her doctor, and I was out of town speaking. And I told her to call me, and she didn't. and she had a mole on her neck, and the doctor said it didn't look right, put her in the hospital, and 5 days later she was dead. She had melanoma cancer. And I was really pissed at God one more time. It's like, God, you know, why do you put something so awesome in my life and then take it away 4.5 years later? You know, and I knew that I needed, like always, to go right. You know, and I wrote for 6 hours till I could get to the point to where I could thank God for the 4.5 years and for the experience that He let me experience for 4.5 years. You know, that I got to experience that one time in my life, even though it was for only 4.5 years. And I got to where that, you know, through that, through this whole deal, you know, I still, when I write, you know, I thank God so much for allowing me to keep my primary purpose. You know, so many people, when they have a loss or they have anything, and they use that excuse to quit doing what they do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I haven't lost my focus, not none. I've gotten busier since Lori died. You know, and I know that God and Lori wants me to keep my primary purpose. As long as I keep my primary purpose, you know, I don't know what God's will is for me. I don't know what His next plan is for me. You know, I don't know if His next plan is another Lori for me in my lifetime. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I know God's will is for me to keep my primary purpose, to be available for the next alcoholic that God puts in my life to work with. So if I'm all sucked up and pissed off at God day after day and sitting at home not answering my phone and bailing on Tim not coming to Portland because Lori died and it's not right because I only got to spend 4.5 years with, I know that's not God's will. I know that I'll miss whatever God's plan is for me if I don't keep my primary purpose and focus of what I'm supposed to be doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm so grateful for the old timers that taught me, no matter what goes on in my life, that my primary purpose has to come first, no matter what. And I've done that for 23 years. You know, there's, I don't know. Tim, did you count how many new people were in that line tonight? Yeah, the new people. 40, 50 new people. Man, you know what? I wish there was something magical I could say up here for you guys tonight to make you guys turn that marble in next year and get your tip. You know, if you guys keep your primary focus like I do for 1 year and let all your bullshit, panty waist little problems, let it go for 1 year and come back and trade that marble in and get a year chip next year, I'll guarantee your life, you'll be amazed when you trade that year chip in next year how different your life will be. Thanks for having me, Tim. God bless you guys.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.